Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country. The kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 79 of Comic Book Nation, the official podcast of comicbook.com. I am your host, Kofi Outlaw, and with me today, I have Matthew Aguilar.
What up?
Janelle Wheeler.
Hey, everybody.
And Connor Casey.
The Four Horsemen are back together.
Yeah, so basically everybody we had this time last week. And back today because we got to clean up a little bit of what we were working on last week, which was WWE's Hell in the Cell, so we're going to do a recap of that. But we've also had some big news drop, so we are going to be discussing Marvel's selection for Moon Knight, our first look at Titan's version of Red Hood and the new Batgirl costume. We have some big gaming news to talk about. Assassin's Creed is getting a Netflix series. Cyberpunk 2077 has been delayed again. So we got to talk about all that news. And in our deep dive today, we're going to be reviewing and talking spoilers about the ending of Batman 3 Jokers. The controversial new Batman kind of Joker continuity storyline came to an end with some big twists and reveals. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to do a review of Borat 2 or Borat subsequent movie film, which is, of course, a hot and or controversial topic right now. Plus, Matt has the new comics of the week. And in our rundown section, we got a few things just to keep you up on before we get out of here. So we're going to drop those for you, too. So we got a good show, and let's get to the news because we got a lot to cover. All right. At the top, like I said, we are going to be talking about Marvel's Moon Knight. So
yeah!
Marvel's Moon Knight is one of the second gen wave of Marvel Disney Plus shows. And the one producer Jim Viscardi has been most excited about. And it's been a big question of who would be playing Mark Spector Moon Knight in the MCU. We've heard all kinds of names, from Keanu Reeves being a long rumored one to dude from Haunting of Hill House and Bly Manor being one of the people who fans were thinking could be a good, you know, economic choice for an actor. But Marvel has kind of surprised everybody and gone bigger, not necessarily bigger than Keanu Reeves, but definitely bigger than just a modest TV actor. They've selected Oscar Isaac, the star of the Star Wars sequel trilogy, Poe Dameron, and of course, X-Men Apocalypse, who played that unfortunate version of Apocalypse, will be getting a second chance at Marvel movie glory by, or Marvel TV show and movie glory by playing Mark Spector Moon Knight. So far, you know, obviously this is not a casting. While it was unexpected, it is not really upsetting anybody that I've seen. People tend, Oscar Isaac is a very much fan approved actor.
Yeah.
And so people are kind of looking forward to his take on Mark Spector Moon Knight. Especially since this will be fun to see him kind of take on the different personas of Mark Spector Moon Knight and deal with the kind of mental instability of the character, which is, like, again, we need a good, fun kind of character actor for that, and Oscar Isaac is very much that.
Other than, like, so going with the whole, you know, split personality thing, other than, like, James McAvoy, there's not someone else that, like, I really see out there that, like, as soon as you mention their name, like, they can handle that. They can handle the multiple sides of this. And, like, Isaac is perfect. Like, I love that casting. I was one of the people who was not on the Keanu Reeves train for Mark Spector. I think this is Isaac's a really thoughtful actor, especially in, like, I mean, not some of his other films outside of, like, the Star Wars universe. And I imagine he signed up for this probably for some of the reasons he signed up for Apocalypse. They were like, hey, you're going to play a really, like, interesting villain that's, like, you get to like work with like real character stuff. And then he got Apocalypse we saw in that. So like, this will be his chance to like really dive into some of the material if they go as far with it as the material actually allows. So I'm excited for that.
And he's got that good kind of racial ambiguity thing going for him too, because Mark Spector is an interesting character. I mean, he's a rabbi's son who becomes a mercenary and gets selected by an Egyptian god. Those are not exactly like soft button topics in today's world. So that kind of identity and who plays that could have been a potential dumpster fire. But this is a very safe bet, for the reason Oscar Isaac is always a safe bet. Because is he, isn't he? You don't really know. So
that book gets dark sometimes.
Yeah.
And so,
oh man, yeah, I want to read it.
We'll see. Yes. Oh, by the way, and this brought up a thing, because the only negative I saw was like some ridiculous stuff I'm not even going to touch on. That was the only of like a few negative tweets that I saw about this casting. But the thing was that we did hear from Comic Book Nation about wanting a like a pull list essentially for like the best books to read of Moon Knight. So I will be pulling that together, and we will be having that as part of the show at some point. Also, please check out, for the love of Lord, because he's very sad he couldn't be here, please check out Jim Ascardi's Instagram story if
it's
you want
so
a
good.
Rundown
it is
on Moon Knight.
Extensive. I mean, honestly, when prepping for the podcast, I actually watched his story because I
it's
felt
like
I was
200
getting,
frames or whatever. I don't know
so
what
so much
Instagram
information.
Are.
His collection is crazy. It's awesome. It's really good to know that the people behind this site are actual like comic book collectors, fans, supporters. Like it's just good, you know?
Well, I'm not sure we'd be able to stay ahead of the competition if we didn't actually know what we were talking about. But there are those sites out there. I'm sure you can find them. All right. So Marvel's Moon Knight. And so this is great because Oscar Isaac won't just be doing this kind of Disney Plus series. This will also open up into future MCU movie roles, something Kevin Feige has already teased. So it'll be interesting to kind of see him on screen with these other people, right, who are left over in the MCU. While we won't get to see Isaac and like Robert Downey Jr., we will get to kind of see him hang out with people like, you know, potentially like Paul Rudd or Mark Ruffalo and stuff like that.
I can't wait for the Doctor Strange meeting.
That's going to be fun.
Doctor Strange is a great one. Like, yeah, there's just a lot of... Oh, I almost said Black Panther. That was sad. All right. Aww. Anyway, so there is, like, yeah, a lot of potentially fun things to do with this character. And I hope we get to see him do the Mr. Knight stuff, just because if you've never seen the end of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Oscar Isaac has a wonderful cameo in that movie where he's Spider-Man 2099. And for this brief period, they do this kind of awesome thing where I hope the Moon Knight series has the same kind of turn for him where he's like really serious and Batman-y in this voiceover in the beginning before it cuts to the scene of him just doing this outright, just stupid comedic riff on the old Spider-Man pointing meme from the old cartoon. But it's really good. And like, yeah, he just has that kind of growling intensity when he wants to, like when he's doing like the superhero voice and stuff. So I would just like to see him be weird and be like in a Mr. Knight mask, like walking around a crime scene with a bunch of regular cops talking to himself and kind of doing that. And like I said, one of my favorite things about Star Wars is the sequel trilogy, if nothing else, is just the kind of offbeat riffing of Poe Dameron, like right from the opening scene of Force Awakens where he's like, do you talk or do I talk? I don't know how this works. Like, the, you know,
right.
Yeah. So this is all going to be great stuff. So yeah, I'm not mad at this at all. And I hope they go with some of the Warren Ellis kind of weird Moon Knight stuff. I've already said that, and kind of do jump around in time and mentality for this character and kind of really make it crazy and confused, like irregular to reflect his mental state and all that stuff. But that's just me. All right, moving right along from Marvel over to DC. Let's talk about Titans. Titans season 3 is coming up and it's going to be exciting. We got some big things happening. The biggest being we'll actually get to see it because it's on HBO Max. So, yeah, well, most of us, sorry, most of us will get to see it.
Oh, no, yeah. Touchy subject.
Yeah, well, one step at a time. It's off DC Universe and now we'll get a chance to see it. But Kieran Walters, who played Jason Todd, a really excellent adaptation of Jason Todd in the first two seasons of Titans, is going to be taking that story arc where Jason Todd becomes Red Hood in the third season of Titans. And HBO Max revealed the first look official images of Kieran Walters as Red Hood. And I have to say, it looks pretty badass in my opinion. Only thing is the mask is a little oversized because I don't know if you've seen Kieran Walters, but yeah, that kid has a big head, man.
Like,
I mean, I love that kid, but he's got a
grill.
What's that, like Dick Tracy villain, like with the anvil head? Like he's got that kind of deal, like
or like a Thanos jawline.
Yeah, so the mask is, I mean, it looks like a big mask on like a tiny man.
I respect the Dick Tracy reference.
But he's going to be, I mean, it looks pretty intimidating for the Titans world. And it, I mean, I'm joking about Kieran Walters, but it looks pretty badass with him with the guns out. I mean, the kind of concept art of it looks pretty good. And I imagine this is going to be, his scenes as Robin were kind of dark and badass, like when he beat down all the cops and stuff. So I'm kind of looking forward to this. And I'm looking forward to Titans season 3 in general. All right. What do you guys think?
No, Red Hood, I love it. I mean,
everybody thinks Red Hood. Yeah, Red Hood thinks serious. We're going to be talking a lot about Red Hood tonight.
Right?
So. Yeah. Jason Todd needed a win this week, so I'm glad the costume turned out well.
But, like, he's popping up, right? So he's popping up in Titans. He's popping up in a new Gotham Knights game. He's taking a bigger role in the comics, not just from, like, Three Jokers, but also, like, in other series. Like, man, it's just the year. And he's getting that animated film, right, with the – with like the phone thing. He is like popular. And like every time something comes out with like Jason Todd in it on social, like everyone goes nuts for Jason Todd. Like, who knew? The character's come a long way. Any character can be redeemed. This should show. Like Typeface, 10 years from now, Typeface is going to be a great character. Who knows?
With resurrection comes redemption.
Typeface.
So, like I said, Titans thing, we're getting Batgirl in addition to Red Hood. So that's going to be pretty exciting. And I like this world of Titans, and I'm kind of happy to see it expand. And I hope people get to enjoy it much more bigger platform on HBO Max, like I said. So nothing to be mad out here either. Man, it's hard to do this show today. There's not a lot to be mad at.
I'm positive.
It really is. Feels
continuing
like it's
continuing our positivity train. Javicia Leslie, who stepped in to be the new Batgirl, who will be the new invented character Ryan Wilder, made her debut in her Batwoman. Batwoman, in her Batwoman costume, and nothing bad to say about
she
this
looks
either.
Awesome.
She looks like the Batwoman costume with a different sort of hair, with kind of natural, more curly, ethnic-looking hair.
I love the red.
Yeah, like, with red highlights in it. That's a nice touch.
Man.
Although, let's be honest. Come on, comic book people. What female crime fighter is really going to stop and put those red highlights in every time? She like, let's stop some of the nonsense. That's kind of almost up there.
And
I'm not going to get too racial about this, but, you know, Black and Latino women, I don't see them stopping every single time to fight. Like, let me get highlights in.
I mean, that's why it kind of made sense before when, like, you know, it's like her hair is like really red, but it turns out to be a wig, right? Yeah. Like it's part of
the costume. Yeah.
So right. Like here it's like, oh, okay. Like they're, yeah, I agree. Like who's gonna, you know, like if Sting were a real superhero, he's not going to put the face paint on every time he goes out. Right? Like it's just not practical.
Do we have any like images of her out of the cowl? Because maybe she just has those highlights all the time. You know, and the cowl is just part of it, and or maybe
honest,
it's just a mask.
Checked. Yeah, I haven't checked too deeply. I mean, hopefully. You could be absolutely right. I hope that's a thing, although that's not a really good secret identity. If you
right, because
that's kind of a bad way.
Yeah, if,
yes,
who is
right.
That Batwoman? She goes to the same highlight person as you.
Like, I get it if you're like bleaching your tips in the 90s because like everyone had that.
Wait. You said, okay, wait, say that one more time.
Bleaching
like
your
shady.
Tips, Kofi.
Thank you. I'm helping
said
you
it
out.
Right. No, I
know.
Said it right the first
but you
time.
Said
it,
I
right.
Think, I know you said it right, but I think you said it very fast, faster
I
than
did
you
say
think.
It fast.
Yeah,
I
so I'm just fast. Making sure we stop.
By the way, Kofi had me double checking like how to say the direct name for Power Rangers after the time for like 10 minutes. I was like Googling 10 minutes. Like, did I say it wrong? Did I say it wrong?
Oh, I didn't call you out. I was making a joke.
After all the whole dizzle thing.
But anyway, so there we go. We've seen our photo of the new Batgirl. She looks good too. Or Batwoman.
Love the cape.
Girl too.
Cape's
so we're,
sick.
Yeah.
Got a little ombre effect. Mm.
Not mad at that. All right, moving right along from DC to gaming. Matt and Connor, you guys are all psyched about this.
Yes, we are.
Assassin's Creed is getting a Netflix series. So there you go.
Yeah, no, Assassin's Creed is going to have a Netflix series that is done by, let's see, Jason Altman and Danielle Krennic will be producing, will be executive producing the series. There was nothing really revealed but a logo, which was a sick logo, by the way. Mm-hmm. And like them essentially like kind of saying the same PR stuff of like, you know, we've celebrated this franchise 10 years, blah, 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 blah. We hope to do all this stuff. But I was actually surprised at, like, I don't know about if you felt this way, Connor. I was actually surprised about, like, how many people were jazzed, even though the movie kept coming up, like, in social a lot. Like, people were still, like, really jazzed to see this in TV form because right. everyone really felt like TV was a better medium than movie.
Well, yeah. Actually, I think that it being a series is the better medium for it because – the movie failed a dozen different ways, but one of the ways that it really stumbled was it thought it needed to keep the way in the past assassin storyline and the Desmond Miles in the lab storyline going at the same time. And unfortunately, even the first game wasn't able to make that very interesting. A lot of people will cite Assassin's Creed 2 as when the series really took off in terms of quality, both from a narrative and gameplay standpoint. I think the series is the perfect form for this to take because you have so many different assassins from different time periods and different parts of the world. And if you tried to cram more than one or even just one's entire story into one season, you're going to get a really cramped movie. You could not tell Ezio Auditore's entire story in one movie. They needed three games to do it.
Yeah.
They needed 1.5 games to do it with. Yeah, because they split it with Altair.
Yeah,
but what's fun with this now is you could tell all of Ezio's story and then not even touch Altair till the third season if you wanted to.
Which you don't even need to because that game sucks. The first one was not good. I didn't like the first one at all. Second one, Brotherhood is the bet to me still, aside from Odyssey.
Thank
still
you.
The best game in the series.
Nobody gives Brotherhood the credit it deserves. It was awesome. It was a refined version of 2. Everybody points to 2 as the better one. No, it's Brotherhood. Villain, better storyline, better city to work in. It's awesome. But and then you can have even more fun because then we can jump to Connor Kenway and Edward Kenway as a pirate. Well, maybe not Connor, but Edward, pirate, pirate season. We got a pirate.
You guys are getting so deep in this.
Here's the thing. Well, so before we move about this, okay, a lot of people, Kobe, just because you don't. Now, a lot of people care about Assassin's Creed.
No. Assassin's Creed is not yet a proven like mainstream.
You said this about Witcher.
About
and you were wrong.
No, I wasn't. Witcher proved itself right. It wasn't proven before that.
There are Assassin's Creed is a $1 million like is a huge franchise.
Okay, as a video game, yes, not as
and?
All around entertainment IP.
Okay,
it's going to be very interesting to see if this
you are correct
can succeed where the movie failed, not just because of taking things like the Animus, but just the kind of circular nature of the game and trying to translate that into an actual kind of compelling
storyline.
Yes, but you're shortchanging the game.
I haven't said anything bad about the game.
You're shortchanging.
Now, if I'm going to get the crap for it, let's just get it out there. But I'm just going to say, now I'm going to say it because I wasn't bashing the games, but now I am.
I didn't say you were bashing. I said you were shortchanging it. You're shortchanging the franchise.
I mean, the franchise success speaks for itself. The numbers speak for itself. I
think so.
But I don't think it's personally, I don't think Assassin's Creed has ever been that good. I think it's a circular kind of boring game, which is why I'm naturally worried about a narrative.
But we're talking about two separate things. Your opinion on the game itself is totally fine. I mean, I get a lot of people don't like it, but a lot of people do. To shortchange its relevance is what I was saying. There is a huge population of people that play these games year in and year out, and it has the sales to prove it. The movie didn't do anything, of course. It was a bomb, but what other franchises have we seen movies be bombs of and we still don't shortchange their relevance?
Minecraft.
There are tons. So don't, I think they're two separate things. I'm not questioning your opinion.
Let me ask this question because this is before, my whole thing was in reference to my potential of, is this like a mainstream going, does this have already established the backings of a mainstream larger entertainment hit? I doubt that. You bring up The Witcher as a good comparison. Because unless I'm wrong and I don't know all the ins and outs about Assassin's Creed, The Witcher had already kind of already proven itself as being multi-platform successful, correct? like it
right.
was a book it, from a book to a game.
Yes.
So we had made those jumps from two very distinct different audiences and it proved branding power that was, you know, over the gap of different media platforms. Like it did, it made itself a success in books and it made itself a success in games before coming to TV. But there was that kind of evidence that the IP itself had this kind of larger, possibly multimedia appeal into it. Unless I'm missing something about the Assassin's Creed franchise, it's still just a popular thing within the niche kind of community of gaming, right?
Well, that's the difference. You're correct. Okay. And it is still, it hasn't had success in a TV show. It hasn't, I mean, it's had novels, but like they've been adaptations and things like that, but it's not a multimedia conglomerate yet.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. That doesn't mean I'm not bashing the game audience. I know how popular that is. All I'm saying is my only worry, I think this is
a niche. All right, Matt. I'm saying is I don't view the gaming audience as niche and small. I think that's the difference of opinion.
Yeah, I'm only viewing that as in comparison. Okay, let's word this more carefully. In comparison to what we're talking about now, which is the platform of mainstream TV, right? That's what we're talking about now. This is where we're going with the franchise. So what I'm kind of questioning is, in terms of like a Game of Thrones or what now The Witcher is, yeah, gaming is comparatively like, I mean, kind of a niche thing compared to mainstream viewership. And so I'm just wondering, will this have the appeal to break out? I mean, it perfectly well can. It's just nothing inherently in the games that make me say like, yes, I would see this on TV and see this is going to be an instant hit on like a Game of Thrones or Witcher level.
Kofi, the reason we're excited for this series is because you're talking about something being a breakout. I think this is the perfect structure of storytelling for this kind of story to break out, because these stories are long, because trying to fit them into a 90-minute to 2-hour movie just isn't going to work.
No way.
You're going to have to cut out a lot or add a lot or completely start from scratch, which was one of the many mistakes they made with the movie. I think this can fit. Keeping it with a seasonal structure like this in a series, you can fit in a lot of what works about the video game's story and take out some of the stuff that you don't like the modern day story, because nobody has ever liked that.
Right.
That's why we're excited.
All right. I mean, I hope you're right. I think this is going to be kind of the do or die moment for the Assassin's Creed as a larger IP too. Because, yeah. All right. But we got another gaming
thing. I'm hopeful. Right? Let's be hopeful.
Well, this one will be quick.
Cyberpunk 2077 is delayed again. Yeah.
So they're sending out all these packages to like influencers to hype people up, and it's like, can't you just wait until you get the date locked?
Only though 21 days. So it comes out December 10th.
Yeah.
It's not as bad, but is this the third or fourth? Is it the third or fourth delay?
It's the third.
It's the third, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like, this is not like, you know, Last Guardian level or anything like that, because this is actually going to come out. We've seen stuff from it, but like, it is funny that like, literally, yeah, people were already getting, like about to get review codes. And it was like, oh yeah, we're pushing it back. So hopefully it comes out when it's supposed to this time. It'll be perfect for Christmas.
Are they saying why, like what the holdup is this time?
They specifically said that the having to ship it to not just multiple platforms, but multiple generations is what kind of held it up, because they're trying to hit all of them. And so because everything's kind of releasing at the same time, plus they're trying to get so many platforms, and that includes, right, like Stadia and like all these other random ones. So yeah, like it was just that.
Okay.
They said that was just becoming too whatever. So that's hence also
why
it's only 21
days. The game is
done. The game is done. I feel like they're just trying to do some other stuff.
So what you're saying is, if you wanted to play this game, blame Stadia. They're the reason.
Blame PS5 and Xbox Series X, probably. I mean, those are probably the big ones. I don't think they're sweating it and delaying things for Stadia. Poor Stadia.
All right. So hopefully we'll get Cyberpunk 2077 by the end of this year. Yeah, that'd be a nice end to 2020 to at least get that. All right, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to deep dive into the end of Batman and the Three Jokers, review Borat 2, talk about WWE, Hell in a Cell, new comics, and the little tidbits we got to share in our rundown. So stay tuned for all of that.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
All right. Batman 3 Joker. So we've been following this series since it came out. This has been one of the more kind of controversial things that DC Comics has released, at least this year. But it's been kind of controversial since we heard about it. The basic premise was this is supposed to be a major cleanup of Batman continuity and Joker continuity that Geoff Johns was going to kind of embark on. And it's been apparent, this was only three books, and we were kind of really wondering how they were going to stick this landing, because the first book kind of established the premise. There are these three Jokers that have been running around DC continuity, and they're based on kind of different eras and versions of the Joker that have become popular, taken prominence, and have been kind of found to be in continuity at the same time. And so the mystery was, which one is the real one? And why have these three Jokers kind of united, and where have they come from? Like, is this some, you know, alt universe colliding stuff? Like, what's going on here? So in Batman 3 Jokers 3, we finally get the conclusion of this mystery, plus a few kind of additional twists at the end. And we kind of get to the purpose of what this series is really about. So we're going to talk about Batman 3 Jokers 3 and the whole series in full spoilers. So this is going to be a full spoiler discussion of Three Jokers. If you want to hear this or preserve the secrets, do not listen right now. Come back after you read it and fast forward for like about 5 minutes or so, because we are going to, like I said, be talking about all of this. All right. So let's just start at the top of some of the big things. So the mystery of the three Jokers. The first thing is, who is the real Joker? There are three. There is the criminal, who was kind of the classic Joker, who was just kind of a crook who had plans and Batman tried to stop. There was the comedian, or the criminal, who was the kind of guy who became more of the sadistic Joker, the one who beat Jason Todd to death and did all of that. And then you had the comedian, which is the one that was kind of spun out of the Alan Moore Killing Joke origin story of the Joker being a failed comedian and shooting Barbara Gordon, paralyzing her, and doing all of that. So the question was, which one of these three is the real one? And we got an answer. And the definitive answer is that the comedian is the real Joker. The Alan Moore Killing Joke Joker was the real one. And he created these other two using, you know, the Joker dye kind of chemical formula that we had seen throughout the series to kind of work with him and really mess with Batman and create this situation where, in a twist, this is a story of the Joker. And there's a lot of parallels. I'll say that right off the bat, because I'm going to compare them a lot between Three Jokers and Joker War. I feel like there was almost like an eternal war at DC Comics, because these stories are very similar in so many ways about basically thematically like what they're trying to do.
They even have the same location.
Yeah, the ending has the same exact kind of Joker plan, where he takes Batman back to the Monarch Theater where his parents died after watching Zorro and making him relive some nightmarish version of that. with like, you know, crazy haunting Joker things all around. So zombies all around. So yeah, but this I think does a clearer job of its thematics than Joker War ever did, in that it does make a clever point that in this story, in the mechanics of what happens in the end, it involves Joe Chill, the guy who killed the Waynes in the early continuity stories of Batman. In one of the earliest, you know, versions of Batman's continuity, Joe Chill was the common criminal who killed the Waynes and was subsequently locked up. And Batman has to save him from Joker trying to transform him into a new Joker. And in doing so, he basically, having saved the man who killed his parents, he reconciles as with Joe Chill, both as Batman and then later as Bruce Wayne, formerly in a hospital where Joe Chill is dying and you know, actually apologizes. And he finds out that Joe Chill had like reformed in prison and became this other kind of person and really just, you know, knew that he was wrong for what he had did out of desperation and poverty and all this stuff. And so Joker actually heals Batman in a very significant way, for the sole purpose so that he can be the only trauma in Batman's life, because he's jealous that Batman has this other trauma. Because Joker knows that Batman is Bruce Wayne, which is the big thing that he and Bruce have, and probably the best scene in this whole series, which is them riding in the back of a police van together after he arrests the comedian. And they have this long conversation. And so, yeah, Joker basically reveals he knows that Batman has always been Bruce Wayne, and he never is going to tell because he doesn't want the game to end, and that this whole three Jokers thing was just to make him appreciate his Joker and not and get over the Joe Chill thing, so there's nothing else kind of traumatizing him, so Joker can be the mass, like the big pain in his life. But the final twist on the story is that Batman, of course, is Batman, and he even says, "I'm Batman."
I love that.
I know how that sounds, but I'm going to say it like I'm Batman. And it turns out that Batman has had the upper hand on this Joker situation the entire time. He's known, A, that the comedian is the real Joker the entire time since they first faced each other, and he knows who the comedian really is, like who his real, what his real name is. But Batman similarly will never reveal that, but not for the reasons the Joker are. And this is your final spoiler for Batman 3 Jokers, because the final scene reveals that Geoff Johns, and this is going to be one of the most, I think, contentious things in DC Comics fandom. Because what Geoff Johns taking basically now another axe to Alan Moore's continuity after Doomsday Clock and kind of now going for the Killing Joke as well, because he takes Alan Moore's story from the Killing Joke for Joker, the origin story, and he either flips it, twists it, or undermines it, depending on how you look at it, to reveal that Joker's wife, who supposedly died in an electrical fire testing a baby bottle heater for their the baby she was pregnant with, didn't really die. She saw him becoming more crazy and turning to criminal activities. And so with the help of the Gotham PD, they kind of did a witness protection on her and got her out of there with her and her baby before she could be hurt. And she's been secretly living in Alaska and raising Joker's son this whole time. And Bruce Wayne knows where they are and kind of routinely checks in on them. So.
Joker.
Sorry, that was my head exploding.
Love that.
Me too.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I think while people will be debating this, I think I even wrote this in the spin out about how this affects Joker's origin, which is that if there is one thing, because both Batman, both Joker War and Three Jokers kind of proposed this, marketed themselves as these kind of definitive endings to stories, but they really are just kind of reboots in a sense of the Batman-Joker relationship and what it means and all that. But this, if nothing else, accomplishes the task of at least adding new intrigue to that rivalry, because now we know that Batman and Joker both know who each other are. We know they both have families, and that instantly just kind of deepens the potential tension, kind of thrill and danger of their relationship, especially with Joker if he ever finds out.
Yeah.
That he has his wife and his actual kid are still alive, and oh, you know, Batman has known all this. And
yeah,
you know,
awesome.
What can happen to that poor kid? Yeah, the poor kid who.
Well, I can't wait for it, but I'm also going to be like heartbroken if something happens to them, because they did such a good job in a very short amount of time. Because that is only revealed in like the final few pages.
Yeah.
So the fact that much is revealed and they get you to care that much about like their situation, like that last shot of them just like eating dinner, like together at their house, like so peaceful. Like,
Matt, I got one big problem with that last little piece you're talking about.
What?
So in one breath, this book says that, hey, the Joker's origin doesn't really matter. It doesn't, it's not as important as people think it is. People are overthinking it. He has that speech to Batman where he goes, it doesn't matter what my real name is. What matters is that we hate each other and that we're going to fight each other forever. And that he's right in that sense. I think
tend to do a lot as people. Careful, because that's the Joker saying that. That's not the
Batman name. Says it too. He says it didn't matter.
Batman,
what the Joker
no, Batman says it to Alfred. And then he says that he wouldn't, like, he wouldn't know. To everybody else acts, except for that very last part, is kept in the dark. Batman only keeps that secret. So to Batman, that doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't matter to Batman.
Here's the thing. This book did not come out in a vacuum. People were running to this book thinking, oh, we're finally going to get some big revelation about the backstory of the Joker. Mm-hmm. And the book kind of turns it around and says, actually, it doesn't really matter what his backstory is. What matters is he's an interesting character, and we tend to overthink it when we try to pin him into, this is a specific origin that he has. Here's the problem with that. Almost on the same page, in opposite panels, they say that, and then they also say, no, this is his definitive background story, because we're saying that the Alan Moore origin story is the legitimate one, even though the Alan Moore story turns around and goes, hey, sometimes I think my backstory was this, sometimes it's this. When it comes to origin stories, I like to think of multiple choice.
Yeah, but the book doesn't actually come out and say that. It doesn't actually, it alludes to certain parts of Alan Moore's thing. Yeah, to certain panels.
Right, but and then you see the wife and kid.
Yeah, but Alan Moore's also origin on the book wasn't supposed to be definitive. It was supposed to be, it was a one-off, and then people sort of took it to mean that. This book goes back
this
and
book
forth.
This book tries to make it sound like that is the definitive one.
No,
showing the kid, that made that look like, no, this is the definitive one.
No, he was the comedian. But as Jeff Johns his other books, though, he cherry picks pieces of all the different things. I mean, it's seen earlier too with like the whole, like, I want to remake another Joker, like all of that stuff that's been planted before. And he just like takes it all, puts it in a pot, picks out what things he wants. So like, yes, there are parts of that Alan Moore story that like, he's the comedian. That is like, okay, that's firm. Like the family thing is firm, but it also doesn't come out and say like, that's Bible. That's what those other lines of like, you know, it doesn't come out and say like, this is the definitive origin. Here are all the pieces. It's still pretty vague on certain things. It just says this one family aspect is for real and legit.
But it isn't by determining that family aspect prove that that Joker is directly connected to that Alan Moore story.
You don't overthink this, because technically
that's what the book is trying to say.
I know, but I think you're overreading this. Like, because technically it's always been a murky continuity, because in continuity, like Batgirl and Jason Todd are not supposed to be injured in the same continuity.
No. Like, and also, can I just make a quick point? The entire Jason Todd subplot in this book was trash. Hot garbage.
I think the stuff with him and Joker was trash. I thought the stuff with him and Batman
him with Barbara.
Trash. Yeah, that was all trash. I don't know why that was in there.
That's all that third issue is for him.
But I think they pull it together by having those three be the three who have to go into the theater, because they are the most
affected. That was a cool moment
by Joker and that whole thing. So, like, I get why. I didn't think this was the best Red Hood story, but he definitely was necessary to what this story was about, because of the legacy of the Joker with all of them.
And Johns just stole lines from Under the Red Hood for some of the dramatic beats in this one.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the Bruce conflict with Jason is always familiar, and kind of they already done the best scene with that at the end of Under the Red Hood. I don't know if you're ever going to get something better than that, but I just want to be careful, because I think that what the book does is, in everything with the Joker, there's always jokes writers like to put into the Joker book, is people saying that their favorite, I think one of the jokes of this book is it's people's opinion that Alan, like, this is an opinion piece. Like, what that monologue said to me, and the way I read it, was that, like, this is a Joker that people love now. it's the one that you don't have to explain, and they love this, the no origin, chaos, force of nature thing.
Yeah.
But at the very end, he goes, but here is a little intrigue, origin, and everybody's like, ooh, like, yeah. You know.
Dangling the carrot.
Yeah, and everybody's then, that refutes that its own idea of the fandom, because obviously Geoff Johns does not agree with that idea. Because if he did, then the final panel of this book wouldn't be a teasing origin twist. It would. Yeah. It's kind of him saying that's BS. Like you actually do stories. Yeah, you'll want a story that has some kind of deeper level to it and some kind of connections and all that. Now, whether you agree with that or not is up to every individual reader. But
yeah, I agree with that.
The book is kind of that monologue from the Joker. It's just anything the Joker says in that grandstanding moment, you got to take with a grain of salt. Like that's what Joker sees. Like he thinks that that's the coolest thing about him. He's undefined and all this. And Batman lets him believe that. It has let him believe that for many years.
Smart.
Because the alternative is more terrible.
I was going to say, like, being the Joker fan, being the hardcore Joker fan that you are, Janelle.
Yay!
What did you feel about this? Because of all of us, you are the biggest Joker fan.
Well, it's
you'll even accept Leto.
Yeah. Oh God, I'm so pumped. Oh man, I'm so sad I wasn't on that podcast with you guys. But you know, I understand that we have so many amazing avid readers who I look up to so much, and I'm trying to expand my knowledge of comic books all the time. So I know that my perspective is a little different. I am the person that's not going to overthink storylines from other comics because I don't have that context. So reading this was honestly an awesome ride for me, the whole thing. You're coming from someone who has not read Batwoman. I don't know her origin story other than what obviously like I've picked up and I understand to know, but I haven't read it all the way through. I haven't read Red Hood's all the way through. So I made a lot of kind of guesses, you know, to understand like the relationship between certain characters to one another. And I think that he did a great job for people if they want to just pick it up having not really much knowledge of it previously. Now this is probably going to change because the more you have me reading things, I am probably going to pull like a AC and be like, what in this other one?
Yeah, Janelle, because it references the previous book so much, I really want to know what your opinion is after you read Killing
Joke. I'm totally down to like, I'm all about it. And I know to pull it back the Joker fandom and all of that fun stuff. I truly believe that if the only payoff was the, you know, dialogue between Batman and Joker where he's saying, you know, I know your identity. I know who you are. And I did this so that, you know, I would be your biggest frustration in life. That wouldn't have been enough for me to really make me excited about the ending of this series. So without that bomb at the end with the family, I would have felt kind of gypped. Honestly, I would have been like, what? And so as a big, huge Joker fan, I'm like, oh my God. Like, I just like it sold it for me. I was so pumped to even just see like the black and white images of him with her. And I was pumped. And so for me, loved it, thought it was great. And I had to have that ending because without that, I would have felt gypped. Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. I also just, by the way to like give Joe Chill like a complete,
so good.
Like that character has been a one panel character and a one shot character for how long? It's like, you see the gun.
Yeah.
And when like he's referenced as the killer, you see the gun and you see the pearls and like, it's just a shadowy figure running off. Like that's the amount of character development that character has had over the years.
I cannot lie. That was really well done.
Yeah. That was really good. And, I loved it. I would say I agree with Kofi. The second book, I didn't need it all. Okay. And the first half of the first issue, I loved. And then like the second half kind of starts to go a little weird.
Is that the kiss one?
Really? Yeah. It's like the second half. So like the first half of the first issue and this whole third issue, I feel like you could put them together and make it one long issue. And I would have adored it. I would have come out like loving this for the most part, as opposed to like kind of bloating it out. Like some of the stuff in between was just not important in the scheme of things. And you know, you could have
really forgettable.
Yeah.
It's except like, for what, the, except for the pool of Joker buzz. On.
Right. Yeah.
I always like call them walkers, scene. Joker walkers.
Yeah. You know, so if you had put that all into like one shot and just made it really big, I think it would have benefited from that.
Yeah, I also thought there was going to be more with them that they did to Red Hood when they beat him unconscious and just left him there. I thought there was going to be more to that, but apparently not.
It's like, no, he's all right. And he's just a little bummed. He's a little pissed. That was it. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, but he's Jason, so he's always pissed. So.
He's always mad.
But, yeah, so if nothing else, like I said, this has been an interesting twist on just renewing interest in the Batman-Joker kind of rivalry. And now what they can do with the storylines that they kind of spin out this. I mean, if that's nothing else, this is what Geoff Johns is famous for. Taking kind of old dangling or stupid things and kind of rearranging them into more interesting things like Joe Chill. So that's Batman 3 Jokers. Check that out. I'm sure there'll be a big graphic novel out soon you can pick up and enjoy. It's probably enjoyable as one big read, like Matt was kind of indicating. We're going to move on to a quick review of Borat 2, Borat subsequent movie film. Yeah, this is out now on Amazon Prime, and I'm sure you've heard about it by now. Now, this is an interesting kind of crossroads because we try to keep things like apolitical and whatnot on the show because that's not really our jam on this show. There's plenty of political podcasts that are excellent to listen to. But, of course, it's kind of hard to do that and talk about Borat at the same time, but I'm going to try because I'm not here to influence anybody's political views or anything or get into that rabbit hole with you. I'm just talking about Borat as a kind of film, as a comedy film, and as a sequel to this, you know, very groundbreaking film that came out before. So if you're not familiar, Sacha Baron Cohen, of course, is a kind of comedic genius of taking and making these characters that provoke certain social reactions from people. He started doing this with, like, the Ali G show and characters like Ali G, who he would kind of use credentials to get interviews with high-ranking people, intellectuals, politicians, and it come out as this kind of European gangster rapper who would say all this kind of really crazy misogynist or just completely ignorant stuff and get real politicians to, like, get in conversations and agree with him. Then he added to that show two more characters who have since now jumped to film as well. All three of them have had their own kind of films, which are, of course, Borat, this guy from Kazakhstan, who was very much anti-Semitic and kind of sexist and you know, had this very kind of naive, idealistic view of America, but was really a vehicle for getting people to admit things like racism, anti-Semitism, sexism, stuff like that in his conversations. And, of course, Bruno, who is a gay fashion reporter who got people to confront things about homosexuality and other things. And so Borat was such a big success, like a major breakthrough success for Sacha Baron Cohen, that when we heard this film was coming up, the first thing we talked about seeing like the trailer was, how can you pull this off? Because the premise of, I mean, Borat's, the whole thing of Sacha Baron Cohen's acts is they seemingly are like one-offs, because once people know the characters, it's impossible to fool them again.
Right.
And that alone is maybe the best genius about Borat 2, is that he gets to do this twice, showing maybe just a stunning lack of like a critical thinking progress in our country, but that the same character could come and fool people twice. And he doesn't, I mean, and he makes jokes about having to, I mean, there are scenes of him walking down the street in like Hollywood or other places where, or in the US, where people recognize him and are chasing him. So he starts buying these elaborate, like, crazy disguises. But he does hang out with real people outside of the disguises, still as obviously Borat,
but it's like who don't know South.
Who... Yeah, in the South, who don't know who he is.
No
and,
idea.
And bring you this crazy guy. I mean, one, like, this redneck guy's bring him to their home and let him,
which
like, stay
at their
home.
Which was very sweet.
Yeah, it was very sweet.
He's like,
not advisable.
I have nowhere to go for quarantine. Yeah. And they're like, come on.
Yeah, and not advisable, but very sweet. But, yeah, and how he can get people twice. And just this way this man infiltrates even just the, what you would think were the most secure and
people
that would see him coming a mile away. I mean, he gets into the RNC and up to Mike Pence on the stage, and he gets into a hotel room with Rudy Giuliani for this elaborate kind of, you know, prank they play on him that you've heard about, I'm sure.
How?
Exactly. And it's just like the way that he outwits people and makes these situations happen is gold.
And
the
then
fact
has
that
the
he does it again
to
yeah,
have
and
it
the right,
like
the
how he gets them to sign off that they can use that footage. Oh my
yeah.
gosh.
And the fact that he does it again is just absurd to begin with. But the ultimate point of this one is a lot more focus on the sexism aspect of Borat, and kind of played through his daughter, who's played by Maria Bakalova, who I think, is she a breakout actress in this? Is this like, no, she's been in a couple things, but yeah, this is her first big.
Yeah, this is like her first huge picture.
Huge picture. And man, good for her is she right. Like she really went for it in
so
this,
good.
Playing Borat's daughter. What's her name? Tutsa?
Forget her name in the...
Tutar. Yeah. So basically, Borat goes back home to Kazakhstan and thinks he's going to be like a celebrity, but because of things, you know, he brought shame to Kazakhstan and things like that. So he's kind of treated as a political prisoner, but he gets a chance to redeem the country and himself if he can go and give a gift to Mike Pence in America. So he's going to go and give him his daughter, his only daughter, who he keeps.
Which is so screwed up. What the hell?
Yeah, we're not going to touch on any of that. We're just going to tell you what happens in the film. Yeah. And, of course, it's this horribly exaggerated jokes about how, you know, the rights of women aren't, you know, how bad they are, in especially some places over, or starting overseas. But then a reflection of that, and, of course, in America, because you would think, oh, this could only happen in a crazy country like Kazakhstan. The girl could be like living outside in a cage and, you know, competing with a cool girl who lives in a bigger cage like next to her. But, you know, I think some of the movie's most shocking things, aside, I think, from the political stuff for me, the more shocking scenes were the, you know, the sexism gender scenes. Mm-hmm. Like when he goes and says like to a guy at a copy store, like, I'm faxing this guy back and forth about like selling my daughter off to this person for like sex and stuff.
Or like, how about that, the man that like literally is like, oh yeah, she's worth this much. Like,
yes.
When his daughter is standing right next
to him. Go to a Southern ball and like, and he says like, how much do you think my daughter's worth? And the guy, without missing a beat, just says, looks at her, up and down and says, this value number. And as they walk away, the camera pans on him. It's like a perfect scene, like out of The Office almost. Like,
yes.
Because Sacha Baron Cohen leaves, but the camera stays on the guy. And his daughter is so like
upset,
disgusted, yeah, and like pissed.
I mean, she calls
like,
him
that
out.
That is, yeah, she's like, that's disgusting. Like, and like, yeah.
She drops an F-bomb on him.
Yeah, it is just.
Well, the dude who sells them the cage.
Yeah.
Is like,
yeah.
There's so many moments like that.
Yeah, you can, how many do you think I can fit here? Like, oh, one, you know, we could do this. And then he like helps him get a propane tank. Like, never questions. Never questions.
One thing that this guy's saying about locking a girl in a cage. Like, it never questions.
What the hell?
Yes, never questions. Oh, man. Like, yeah. And so that stuff was kind of the shocking, scarier stuff for me. Because the political stuff I felt almost was like, I mean, it's weird to say, but I mean, at this point, it was like, yeah, it was like easy. It's like low hanging fruit.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, even the Giuliani thing, which I'm not going to say except gross, but was like low-hanging fruit. No matter what your view of it was, gross. But like, yeah, the stuff about it, I didn't expect some of the stuff about the sexism and things like that. And just the gender inequality. And just, yeah, I mean, just the things that he's plainly setting up, giving people the chance to just say something normal and civilized and just to have them. And the facts guy, the facts guy is like, my favorite. That guy is just complicit in everything this guy does.
Yeah.
He's talking about the guy getting killed, like this whole crazy story. He never blinks an eye.
Just well, I do love, I laughed out loud when the first time he goes in there and he writes the message and he says, what do you want to say? And he says, sup. I don't know why that made me like, I laughed out loud. I don't know why. I was just like, that's funny.
Yeah. No, so funny. It was very good. And yes, the girl plays Tuta does, I mean, just stone. She has
incredible.
Real cojones. Like, she just
really
going
does.
To that feminist dinner and then talking to them about, like, the whole story about from the little fairy tale book about anatomy that she has and all that stuff.
I can't.
And just telling that room full of women, like, let's all get exposed and play with ourselves together. And later, somebody's finally like, let's get her an Uber.
Like, yeah. Because that's the thing, right? It's not, like, it's one thing if, like, everyone's in on the scene. It's not that way in these movies. So it's just like, no, that's real. That's like real people react. You know what I mean?
Real,
it's like,
awkward. That is real awkwardness you are looking at.
Jeez, man.
Yeah. The one, although every Borat scene, I mean, Borat 1 had the one where him and his lawyer were running down the hall naked through that hotel. And they top it in this one, I think, with the Southern dance, with the Southern bell ball,
God.
With the dance routine.
No.
Yeah.
About to leave.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but like, yeah, we won't get any more gross than that, but that one will stay with you for a long time, I'm sure, because yeah, they really freaked out a room full of people with that. But yeah, it was amazing, like, that he was able to kind of recapture that magic again, in even a more pointed, serious way, weirdly, than the first Borat, which was, like I said, tackled serious subjects, but it felt more silly and irreverent than this, which feels more pointed and serious. I gotta say, I didn't think I would be able to enjoy it a second time. I was really skeptical. It feels like this is gonna feel old, but this was good. And the costume, I love that he's in costume as Borat, but the level of costumes he puts on top of that.
Yeah.
Like the cowboy when he goes up and sings the song.
Oh,
like that song that he makes
my
up.
My gosh.
Janelle Wheeler, I think we found your first hit if you want to clean up.
That, honest to God, I think that was the scene that messed me up the most, because the fact that that's a real thing that's happening. Mm-hmm. Like, not him, the grouping of people that are gathering for that, the reason that they're gathering for, and how much they literally buy into that one narrative. I'm just like, I was sick to my stomach, honestly.
Yeah, it's a pretty shocking expose about things that are really going on down in the,
well, you think we're in the South, but we're in a city. So yeah,
we're in Nashville.
Yeah.
This is very much like, going on. It's pretty surprising on some levels. And just, I think what the most shocking thing for me of the whole film was just seeing him in the cabin with the two redneck guys and just hearing them recite things they think are true.
Oh my gosh.
And it was just kind of like, okay. But yeah, we're not going to get into that, because I can see our comment section starting to get up, and I'm not speaking about all rednecks. There are plenty of wise redneck people. My family is from a freaking crater town in Kentucky. I know about the wisdom of weird country folk. But this was disturbing on some level. So that's Borat. Check that out. It's on Amazon Prime. It is free. This was
better than
surprising
I thought it would be.
Question that came up a lot, but it's free. So you can check that out. All right, guys. Why don't you give us a recap of WWE Hell in a Cell? And Matt will tell us about comics before we give you the quick rundown on our way out of here.
Well, Matt, we're going to talk about Hell in a Cell. So I brought out my signed New Day poster because I need some power of positivity. You got me this, by the way. Thank you for that.
That's majestic.
It's awesome.
It is. I love it. So this was a good show. This had two excellent Hell in a Cell matches. The storytelling between Roman and Jay was spectacular, just like last time. Roman crying at the end. Pretending to come to some sort of realization that he is now a monster was just fantastic work. Sasha and Bayley was every bit as good as I thought it would be in terms of the match. People are saying, is this better than TakeOver or not? Personally, I think the only thing that leans in TakeOver's favor is live crowd. There was no live crowd for this, so yeah. And all the reactions were panned. But 5 years from now, we might be saying the opposite. Who knows?
Yeah.
Then we get to the main event. Randy Orton won in what felt like a very slow match. Drew McIntyre's reign as WWE champion is over.
Ooh.
And Randy, here's the thing. From WrestleMania to SummerSlam, Randy Orton was the hottest heel in WWE. Maybe in all of wrestling, if you want to expand a little bit further. Everything he did was interesting. He brought back the punt. He brought back the legend killer. He had Ric Flair as his manager. Every match was this obviously calculated thing where he barely had to wrestle. Like you remember the Christian match where it's like, oh my God, we're getting an unsanctioned match. Christian's making a return. Low blow. Nope. Turns out it was a ruse. Like everything he did, you could tell there was a thought to it. And then he loses SummerSlam. He loses it Payback in 6 minutes. He loses a Clash of Champions. Guys lost three pay-per-views in a row and then decides to have a really slow Hell in a Cell match where two big buff guys have to climb up and down a 20-foot cage. Takes about 10 minutes to do that. I'm not happy about this. And Raw did not assuade me. It did not make me feel better about the situation.
You didn't like the pen stabbing?
Well, we don't even get that. We didn't even get on the show. They cut that.
That was after.
It's like, you're going to have him try to lose an eye and that's on the YouTube page? Like, what the hell? And then, and you'll probably have feelings about this, NXT will not be taking part in this year's Survivor Series. The thing that made Survivor Series last year probably the best show of the year, made it the most exciting at least, it's gone. No reason, even though they won. Help me out here, man. I'm struggling.
Well, I can't help you out on the Orton thing, because I thought that match was a turd. That match was trash. Like, it was so...
You know what that felt like? It felt like a late 2000s Triple H main event.
Yes.
Where it's very slow-paced, and the finish entirely comes down to who counters whose finisher first.
Yeah, it was very... It was boring Orton. Sorry, Jim. It was boring. It was boring Orton, and I love Drew, and I think Drew works when you have a compelling villain on the other side, and I will even give it to them that the first matchup of these two had that. I thought Orton was a little more like
right
mean and Orton. I thought that was good, and then we got to the second one, and it was like
it was back to being hokey. And it's funny how the SummerSlam match was more violent than the one inside of the career-ending steel cage.
Yeah, and then like half of it's outside the cell. I'm like, he just like opened the door. I was like, okay. What's the, I thought the whole point was supposed to be you were supposed to be inside here. And then like the whole thing about Drew climbing up the side was just like, it was dare me. It was like, I dare you. Like literally Orton climbs up, says nothing, and it's just like looking down on him. And we're just supposed to think like, why? What common sense person is going to go up to the top?
And let me ask you this, the entirety of the time what they were up there, did you think one guy was getting thrown off or thrown through the roof?
Yeah.
No. I thought they were going to do something.
I thought they were going to do something.
Not for 1 second.
Ever
since they made that cell 20 feet high, the only way you're jumping off is if Shane McMahon does it onto a crash pad. That's it.
So, that's true. But, I mean, it would have needed that. And then, like, Drew goes through it, whatever. It was, yeah, that was lame. But I will say, the first 75% of that show, pretty good. And Bayley-Sasha was a classic.
Yeah.
And I got to say, as heartbroken as I was that Otis was betrayed and does not have the briefcase, I did actually find it interesting. And I did think that pushes things. He just better not leave SmackDown. So, like, I am also bummed about the NXT thing. I will say it's kind of a weird thing because, like, I'm sort of torn because – while I'm bummed that they're not going to be a part of it, because I agree, they were the best part of it because of just all the original opportunities you have because you throw them in. Mm-hmm. I also am perfectly happy with like Vince not touching NXT in any way, shape, or form. And last time we had a crossover, we ended up like almost every time that like they cross over with NXT, NXT suffers more than the normal amount. Like they get saddled with feuds that like I feel like just put NXT in a dimmer light and always shine the light on the superstars, as opposed to them winning the Survivor Series. Like that's why I shocked everybody, is because that would never happen typically. But I don't love that. So I'm kind of happy with just like leave them alone.
See, I'm with you on Vince keeping his distance from them is great. That's always when the show benefits. The problem is that Survivor Series gets pushed as this battle for brand supremacy. Whenever I write that in a story, I put quotes around it because they say it that much. It might as well be the tagline. And they always say, this is the one time of year where the two sides feud with each other. No, it's really not. These guys jump back and forth between shows all the time. They're wrestling each other on a whim on opposite brands. But the split between Raw and SmackDown and NXT was always legitimate because it was always thought of, oh, you get called up. All that talk last year of NXT being the legitimate third brand, it's gone. It's kind of, it's where is that now? Even though they're on the exact same network as Monday Night Raw, their supposed A show, even though it's really not.
It's really not anymore. I mean, that speaks to like a lot of things about WWE. And then I know we got to wrap and move on, but like,
I know, but
that speaks to a lot of things about WWE, right? Like, Raw's supposed to be the main show. It's not. SmackDown is, because it's on Fox. Like, there are so many of those things that, like, perceived, and it's not really that way. And, yeah, I mean, I agree. The whole third brand thing is kind of, for a minute there, it's all they were saying. And Triple H still says it in press conferences, to be fair.
Yeah.
But no one else really says it. And I don't know why the reason is to not have them. I think it's detrimental to the pay-per-view, because that's the really the only reason I was interested, was that you had that legitimate competition. No one cares about SmackDown versus Raw anymore. Braun Strowman just wanders the halls of whatever show is on and just appears. Like, I don't know. There's no real brand split, especially with that wild card rule crap that they tried to pull last time. Thankfully, that's gone. But
basically, Survivor Series, we got 6 matches announced already. My interest in them is pretty much already drained. It's not there. So that's where we're at, Kofi.
Yeah. Wrestling.
Okay. Well, Matt, why don't you give us the – well, let's go through a quick rundown, and then we'll end on new comics, because we'll just take us out on that.
Cool.
Just in our rundown real quick, these are just quick mentions from different genres that we don't have time to talk in full about, but we want to put you on to. There's a new trailer for the Blumhouse movie Freaky, which, you know, I love a good horror movie concept, high concept from Blumhouse. If you liked Happy Death Day, this basically takes the idea of Freaky Friday and marries it to a slasher film with a teenage high school cheerleader who wakes up in the body of a serial killer who's played by Vince Vaughn. And the serial killer is, of course, now in her body masquerading as a teenage cheerleading queen. And it looks fun.
It looks so fun.
Good trailer. It looks like a lot of fun. Vince Vaughn looks like he's going to actually give a really good Vince Vaughn performance for first time in a very long time, but it also plays up on his role in Psycho, which was a big breakout role for him for the Psycho remake, playing Norman Bates. So this is kind of a funny send-up of that, and like I said, I love Blumhouse's high-concept horror films, and this one looks like a lot of fun, like Happy Death Day. American Gods Season 3 has been announced. We were all wondering if this is when this was coming, but now it's going to be here on January 10th, 2021. So if you're one of the people still using the Stars app, I guess you can see this, or otherwise, yeah.
Do you guys watch the show, or have you?
I did. Season 2 was trash.
Okay, like, I watched season 1, but then I stopped.
Season 1 was great.
Okay.
Season 1 was great. Season 2, absolute trash.
Bummer.
And season 3, now Stars has kind of fallen off because they got pulled from at least Xfinity Cable. I don't know about other cable providers. But they got pulled from Comcast, so now you just have to go and pay for, like, entirely Starz streaming, which is never going to be something I do. Outlander is not that good, guys. Sorry. And as much as I love the Power universe, I ain't paying you for that. So that's that. American Gods 3 is coming up, if you care. Matt, you had some other quick rundown mentions?
Yeah, it's just a quick thing in Power Rangers land. So today, the movie reboot we talked about last time got a writer, Brian Edward Hill, who is like a writer from DC, Marvel, Boom, will be handling the script for the movie. So I'm very stoked for that, mostly because while Fallen Angels was bad, except for that first issue, I actually liked the first issue, but everything else was bad. But Angel was fantastic. So again, when we do like James Tynion and talk about writers, like sometimes they have a bad project, but other ones are good. So I'm hopeful that we get Angel side of this for Power Rangers. Also, by the way, just as a shout out, be on the lookout on Friday for some big Power Rangers news coming from comicbook.com. Can't tell you what yet, but it will be there. So stick around.
All right.
Exclusive.
Cool.
Yes, exclusive. Booyah.
Oh, baby. Better listen to that Friday show as well. Now, Matt, take us out with what new comics are coming out this week besides Three Jokers.
All right. So, yes, of course, we talked about Three Jokers. We also have The Amazing Spider-Man number 51, Action Comics number 1026, which has actually been really good lately. I've been digging Superman. We have Wonder Woman number 765. We have The Immortal Hulk number 39, which took me way too long to get on board with, but it is very good. So Jim was right. Batgirl number 50, the final issue in that series. We also have Ten of Swords Stasis number 1, Suicide Squad number 10, Department of Truth number 2, TMNT The Last Ronin number 1, which I know Jamie Lovett had some thoughts about, Star Wars Dr. Aphra number 5, Wind number 5, Power Rangers Dragon New Dawn number 3, which is the final issue of that series, An Unkindness of Ravens number 2, Giga, I believe I'm saying that correctly, number 1, which actually has a really cool premise from Vault Comics, and then Heavy number 2, which is the second issue of that series I talked about before, where the guy dies and he's kind of his family, he's trying to get like to the other side, and he's like a hitman in the afterlife, and it's this weird thing, and then they dropped a huge bomb on the final page, and now we get the second issue of that. So definitely check that out if you're looking for something kind of different. So that is comics.
All right, that'll do it for this episode of Comic Book Nation. We want to thank you guys for tuning in. As always, we put up new episodes every Wednesday and every Friday on comicbook.com. You can listen on the site, you can listen on your favorite podcast platform, which include Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio. You can tell your smart home devices to fire up Comic Book Nation podcasts or you can watch episodes live on Facebook every Wednesday and Friday. If you miss the live episodes, they are always backed up on the Comic Book Nation YouTube page. If you want to contact us or get involved in the show and follow what's going on, subscribe or follow now. Follow the at Comic Book Nation Twitter account now, or you can follow us individually. I'm at Kofi Outlaw.
I am at Matt Aguilar CB.
I'm Janelle Wheeler. You guys know where to find me on Twitch and all the socials.
And Connor Casey underscore CB.
If you like the show, go on Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review. One day when COVID is died down and we can get in our merch closet at the offices again, we'll be sending out t-shirts to our 5-star reviewers. A lot of you have been dropping them. We thank you. Continue to do so because we'll show that appreciation back to you. Otherwise, we'll see you guys for our next episode. Be sure to listen in to some of our previous ones if you just are getting in the show or missed them. And yeah, stay checked in, stay tuned in. We'll see you on the next Comic Book Nation. Peace.
Peace.
Later.